It's the NPR News Update for Thursday, August 7th, Minnesota's news on your schedule. I'm Matt Setbick in for Phil Picardi. In the news today, a Mendota Heights police officer killed in the line of duty is laid to rest. People who live near railroad tracks are concerned about the increasing number of oil trains passing by. And we sit down with Kurt Zellers, one of the four Republican gubernatorial hopefuls. He talks about his vision for Minnesota. In other news today, University of Minnesota President Eric Kaler says the U will try to prevent the use of the Washington Redskins name when the NFL team plays the Vikings at TCF Bank Stadium. Brett Neely has more.
In a letter to Congresswoman Betty McCollum, Kaler says he finds the team's name offensive and agrees with those who believe it should be replaced. Kaler says he's working with the Vikings to eliminate the use of the name in publicity materials and public address announcements. The team plays the Vikings on November 2nd. The Vikings are playing at the university stadium while a new Viking stadium is built. McCollum, who's the chair of the Congressional Native American Caucus, has been campaigning against the team's name since last year. She's vowed to lead protests against the Washington team's name on game day. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
The Minneapolis Park Board says it doesn't want to be in charge of the so-called yard. That's the two-block park space that'll be next to the new Vikings Stadium. The board voted 6-2 Wednesday night to drop out of the planning process for the space, which is being turned over to the city of Minneapolis as part of a larger Wells Fargo development nearby. Anita Tabb is a park board commissioner.
It feels as if it's more of an event space than it does a park space, a public park space. It doesn't feel as if it's a park to the majority of us. Obviously, not everyone voted that way, but I think the majority feel as if it really is sort of an extension of a convention center or some other venue that really is there to be rented out.
Tab says she's concerned about the rights the Vikings have to the space during the football season and how that could set a precedent for other park board properties in the city. State health officials say the risk of Ebola spreading to Minnesota is very low. The state's health department hosted a meeting in Brooklyn Center Wednesday night to ease worries and educate the public about the disease, which has killed more than 930 people in four West African countries. Some at the meeting voiced concerns about possible local outbreaks. The Northwest Twin Cities Metro has a significant West African population. Dr. Aaron DeVries is medical director of the Infectious Disease Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. He says the virus is spread through contact with blood or bodily fluids.
The risk of catching Ebola in the general public is very importantly extremely low, and there has not been any transmission of Ebola in the United States. It's not spread through casual contact. Even among people who have traveled to countries in West Africa where outbreak is occurring.
Despite the low risk, DeVries says the state is in contact with healthcare providers across Minnesota about common Ebola symptoms, especially for patients who've traveled to West Africa. A Mendota Heights police officer killed in the line of duty last week was laid to rest yesterday. Law enforcement personnel and members of the public came from across the state to remember an officer, husband, and father who was killed during a traffic stop in West St. Paul. Sasha Eslanian reports.
Scott Patrick served the Mendota Heights Police Department for nearly two decades and the Shakopee Police Department for several years before that. The 47-year-old officer leaves behind a wife and two teenage daughters. Scott Patrick was one of 11 brothers. Mike Brew eulogized his brother as a man who knew the risks of the job and didn't hold regrets.
This kid from St. Paul's West Side, with the frequent smile, the low-key demeanor, the guy who could toss out witty one-line crackers, as my brother Mark has called them. They'd bring smiles, took the edge off of stressful situations. This big-picture problem solver was living a lot of his dream. Then in an instant, he's gone. And we grieve deeply.
That instant came a week ago when Patrick pulled over Brian Fitch Sr., a career criminal who now faces first-degree murder charges for allegedly shooting Patrick during the stop. Officer Robert Lambert described Patrick as a close colleague devoted to serving his community.
He never forgot where he came from. He never looked at himself as being better than anyone else. That is the biggest lesson that I've learned from him, to remain humble and deeply rooted in the values and morals that have guided you. to whatever successes you have achieved in your life. I will miss my brother. Scott, I love you. We love you. Rest now. We'll take your watch from here.
After the funeral, two solid lines of law enforcement vehicles proceeded slowly down Charlton Avenue in West St. Paul toward Acacia Park Cemetery in Mendota Heights. Nick Corey sat with a cardboard box of stickers bearing Patrick's badge number. The family began selling them as a fundraiser at their Lilydale coffee shop to benefit the Patrick family.
Officer Patrick knew our family. My dad was actually in a car accident a year or so back, and Officer Patrick was the first one on the scene and helped him out.
25-year-old Samantha Brown of West St. Paul stood with a sign saying, "Thank you."
I was 18 when I was called to jury duty on a gang rape case that happened in Mendota Heights, and he was the responding officer and investigator on that case. So I spent 2 days with him in his testimony. He was an amazing man that loved his job and took such care of the victim in that case.
Others didn't know Scott Patrick personally, but wanted to show their support. Suad Gubash tossed flower petals at the passing squad cars, a tradition from her native Lebanon.
We are very sad to lose the policeman, Scott, but so we try to tell them we really love him so much and appreciate what he has done.
Many families and children lined the route. It had echoes of a 4th of July parade, a summer day, flags, lawn chairs, children. But silence, squad cars, and somber adults conveyed the gravity of the day. Sarah Kirkwood brought her two sons to witness the number of lives that can be touched by one death.
Every car that drives by, you know that sometime today that a police officer has thought this could be my own funeral. And so it's very eerie in a way. We're here to honor this person, but to also honor all these other people that every day risk their lives for us. They don't even know us.
At the cemetery, bells tolled 272 times, one for each Minnesota officer killed in the line of duty, and 22 times for each year Scott Patrick served as a police officer. Sasha Aslanian, Minnesota Public Radio News, West St. Paul.
A former Hennepin County sheriff's deputy has reached a settlement with the county over a federal sex and race discrimination complaint she filed last year. Lieutenant June Johnson claimed the working environment in the sheriff's office had been hostile to black women for decades. Under the agreement, Johnson dismissed her complaint and the county admits no liability. Brant Williams reports.
Under the terms of the four-page settlement agreement reached quietly in April, the county paid Johnson $21,000 for her claims of emotional damages, and Johnson agreed to retire. Hennepin County Sheriff's Office spokeswoman Jennifer Johnson says Sheriff Rich Stanek does not comment publicly on personnel matters. She released a written statement saying, quote, "As outlined in the agreement, the settlement does not constitute an admission by the county of any wrongdoing or liability. Instead, the mutual agreement allows both parties to discontinue conversation and go their separate ways." June Johnson also declined to comment on the settlement. When Johnson filed her complaint with the EEOC last fall, she'd been on the force for 27 years. She told NPR News in October that over the years, she'd been subjected to unfair treatment based on her race, gender, and age. Johnson, who is African-American, said in the interview, the problem started under a previous administration, but did not get better under Stanek.
In my opinion, the sheriff's office, they completely disregarded and dismissed any of the concerns and issues that I had.
Johnson's allegations included an instance she says happened shortly after she was promoted to sergeant in 1998, long before Stanek was elected in 2006. She says a male supervisor made a lewd comment about her body. Johnson says she told another supervisor about the incident. But she says nothing was done for 6 years until Johnson and the other sergeant were each transferred to different areas. Then in 2011, Johnson says the man she claims harassed her was transferred to the division she worked in until she retired.
And the fact that the sheriff's office would not even remove me from that tells me that they did not take what I said seriously.
Johnson said the county's Human Resources Department did investigate her claims, but found them baseless. Not long after Johnson's story was broadcast by NPR News, her attorney at the time, Catherine Engdahl, reported that Johnson experienced retaliation. According to Engdahl, Johnson found a bullseye target commonly found at gun ranges in her work mailbox and the word silence written across the target. Johnson says she was placed on administrative leave while the sheriff's office conducted an investigation. However, she says the probe didn't find out who threatened her. Reverend Jerry McAfee, president of the Minneapolis NAACP, helped Johnson announce her complaint to the public and has served as an advisor. McAfee says Johnson is satisfied with the settlement agreement. However, he says Johnson feels hurt by the whole experience.
I think she would have loved to have been able to leave under a different set of circumstances.
McAfee says he's spoken with a high-ranking official in the sheriff's office who assured him the office would address some of the matters Johnson had complained about. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
To see the settlement between June Johnson and Hennepin County, you can go to mprnews.org. Trains carrying millions of gallons of crude oil clatter through the Twin Cities every day, and that's a growing concern for people who live and work alongside the tracks. The sheer density of metro communities makes them especially vulnerable if a train were to derail and erupt, as one did in Quebec last year. Reporter Laura Ewan looks at how a close call in one Twin Cities suburb has worried some residents.
When a train careened off the tracks in Fridley early one summer morning in 2011, nothing could have prepared Mary Jo Chaplesky for the sight.
Well, when I woke up and looked out my window and the whole lake was yellow, I couldn't imagine in my wildest dreams what it was.
Chaplesky walked the two blocks from her lakefront home to the crash site, where she saw a tipped over locomotive, a smashed railroad bridge, and 17 derailed train cars. She soon discovered why the lake was yellow.
You saw this mess of railroad cars and corn, and I couldn't believe my eyes.
Corn, dozens of tons of it, spilled into Lock Lake, as well as hundreds of gallons of diesel. And while the spill led to a unique set of problems, Chaplesky and other residents know it could have been much worse.
If a train with oil derailed and exploded, these people wouldn't have a chance.
Fridley sits on one of the main routes that hauled volatile crude oil from North Dakota to East Coast refineries. About three-quarters of oil harvested from the booming Bakken oil fields end up on a train through Minnesota. Typically, that amounts to 50 million gallons a week. A package of legislative reforms that went into effect last month aims to make Minnesota's crude oil freeways safer. As part of the changes, more inspectors will be hired to scrutinize the tracks. Dave Christensen is the Minnesota Department of Transportation's point person on freight rail. The MnDOT staff is mapping the safety risks of all 500 rail crossings along the oil routes, where trains may intersect with cars and trucks. One factor the department is looking at, how many vulnerable populations, such as nursing homes, hospitals, and schools, are situated next to those intersections.
If something happens, the first and most effective response is to evacuate people out of the half-mile range as soon as possible. Response within the first 10 or 15 minutes is absolutely critical. And if you've got a fixed or vulnerable population, that's going to be hard to do.
Christensen says the bigger population centers, such as the Twin Cities, St. Cloud, and Fargo-Moorhead, will carry higher risks of injury or death simply because of their size. The state's rankings will help prioritize which crossings should get a sliver of the $2 million set aside for upgrades. The state is also finalizing a plan to train emergency responders and determine how best to share special firefighting equipment. By Christensen's rough estimate, only about half of Minnesota communities along the oil routes have been trained to respond to a catastrophe involving the highly flammable crude oil. A BNSF spokeswoman says the railroad has begun sending emergency responders to special out-of-state training. And this spring, the industry agreed to slow train speeds to 40 miles per hour in urban areas, including the Twin Cities. But some advocates think the state and federal governments need to do more.
Bianca, big noise. 9-year-old, sister of Alyssa, big noise.
Last week, the environmental group MN350 honored the victims of the Lac-Mégantic derailment in Quebec by reading the names of the 47 people who died in the fireball. This town hall meeting unfolds on a bridge over an expansive BNSF operating rail yard in Minneapolis.
Just look around. There's an oil train here. There's an oil train moving right there.
State Representative Frank Hornstein tells the crowd the spike in oil traffic is a real cause for concern.
The sheer amount, the sheer volume is unprecedented.
The Minneapolis DFLer authored the rail safety bill and says policymakers are just beginning to wrap their arms around the issue. He notes that the National Transportation Safety Board has urged federal regulators to protect the public from oil spills and fires by selecting routes that would avoid population centers.
This system, as it's currently constructed, with the types of cars, with the types of oil, going through populated areas is unacceptable.
The federal government recently proposed new rules that would improve the safety of tanker cars. For Hornstein and other state officials who have seen Minnesota railways turn into national crude oil arteries, those changes can't come soon enough. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News, Fridley.
It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Minnesotans no longer need a good excuse to vote early. Starting with next week's primary, voters do not have to provide any justification for submitting a ballot before Election Day. Supporters of the change say it'll increase access to the polls and could increase voter turnout. But the early absentee returns suggest voters have not entirely embraced their new freedom. Tom Scheck has more.
For years, Minnesotans could only vote early if they could provide a legally valid excuse, such as being outside of the district on Election Day. Dropping that requirement is one of the biggest changes to Minnesota's election system in years, and the candidates and political parties are trying to capitalize on it.
Hello, Marty Seifert. Good to see you. Hi,
governor. Marty Seifert is one of four Republicans seeking the party's nomination for governor. Greeting voters at the Anoka County Fair, Seifert tried to persuade potential supporters to take advantage of the new law.
You can vote early at the government center now, yeah, or the county courthouse, so sneak in and vote early if you want.
Seifert says he's been telling nearly everyone to vote early if they can't make it to the polls on August 12th.
So we have it right on our voter card. We put our thumb on there and say you can vote early at the courthouse.
Seifert said his campaign staff organized a vote early event at an assisted living facility, and he also convinced a group of younger voters to vote absentee in Lyon County.
Those are all first-time voters, so those are people that are not in the polling data. They're not people that folks are thinking about, but we're locking those votes in.
With such uncertainty over how many votes it will take to win what's expected to be a low turnout primary, all of the GOP gubernatorial candidates are trying to lock in as many votes as they can as early as they can. Scott Honor says many voters don't even know about the primary.
We've also gotten a positive response from people that just said, look, I'm busy, I'm working, I might be out of town, I don't know. It's good to know that I have that chance to vote.
Even though the political parties and the campaigns were expecting a surge in absentee voting as a result of the new law, the numbers aren't yet bearing that out. The Secretary of State's office says the number of absentee ballots returned and accepted this year is not at the same level of the 2010 gubernatorial primary. Representative Kurt Zellers says he's finding that some voters prefer the more traditional way of casting a vote.
There's still a lot of them that say, no, I know that I can vote early, but I want to go in there and I want to vote in the ballot box.
Hennepin County Commissioner Jeff Johnson says he's relying on the backing of the party to help him turn out the vote. Johnson, who won the party endorsement in June, says the Republican Party has been active in contacting voters and encouraging them to vote absentee.
And while the party maybe isn't quite to the place it was 6 or 8 years ago, the party's doing pretty well, and they have a really strong statewide plan.
Party Chair Keith Downey acknowledged that Republicans aren't attracting as many absentee voters as Democrats did in 2010, but he said DFL candidates spent more money on the race that year. Downey says the party will have a robust absentee ballot campaign for the upcoming general election. DFL Party Chair Ken Martin says his party is also using the primary to test its absentee ballot campaign. Martin said it will help his party identify and turn out DFL voters who normally wouldn't vote in an off-year election.
This new tool allows us to essentially bank votes early and take those people off of our list and not have to spend any more time, energy, or money on chasing their vote.
Martin also said the parties will be able to learn which voters returned an absentee ballot, giving them a greater ability to determine who they need to lobby to vote before Election Day. The Secretary of State's office says voters can request an absentee ballot and check its status at mnvotes.org. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Today we continue our conversations with the four leading Republican candidates on the ballot Tuesday as voters in Minnesota decide who will get to run against DFL Governor Mark Dayton in November. We've heard from the four in joint appearances in debates here and elsewhere. All are conservatives, all are in their 40s. Three of the four have served in the Minnesota House, and three of the four are Minnesota natives. This is a chance to sit down with each of them and get past the barbs and policy points to get a better sense of who they are and why they're running for office. Today, Kurt Zellers of Maple Grove. Zellers has served in the Minnesota House for more than a decade, and he was Speaker from 2011 to 2013. NPR's Tom Cram asked him about an early political memory.
Yeah, there's two things. My grandma was a one-room schoolhouse teacher when she graduated from at that point, it was Mayville State, but it was a teaching college. And I asked her one time when she voted for Ronald Reagan, I said, why did you vote for, you know, him, Grandma? And, well, you know, you're never supposed to ask anybody who you voted for, but I'll tell you, because he believes in his fellow Americans. He doesn't believe in government, doesn't believe that, you know, everything should be done by the government. You know, you need a little bit and a helping hand every so often, but he believes in us. And that's who I want to see in my president. And my grandpa, who was also very close to me, one time we were driving around in a field and I saw a bunch of cattails that were sitting, you know, farmland that wasn't being farmed. And I asked him one time, I said, so why aren't you farming that over there? And he said, well, somebody from the government came and told us that's a wetland and now we can't farm it. And I thought, well, that's strange. He said, yeah, Kurt, that's what happens when the government tells you what to do when you're farming. And it was two of the probably most, to me, discerning moments that, you know, the positive and also, you know, the challenges that come with too much government, especially in agriculture.
What in your life before this run for governor set you up, in your opinion, to be the most qualified of the four Republicans?
You know, I think it's honestly, it's life experiences. You know, after I lost the opportunity to earn a scholarship, I didn't even get a scholarship at school. I had to work my way through college. And you know, quite honestly, I worked at a Dayton Hudson's in Grand Forks, North Dakota. So if I wouldn't have been so good at selling shirts, I don't know if Governor Dayton would have had all the money to run the first time for office. But I, you know, dealt blackjack to pay my way through school. I bagged groceries. You know, I've actually, like a lot of Minnesotans, I've lost my job. You know, I had to go home and say to my wife, Kim, who's a public school teacher, honey, we lost 60% of our income. Now what do we do? And so I think the Minnesotans out there that are underemployed or have lost a job, they want somebody that's not just going to say they're going to help them, but they know what they've been through. You know how hard it is to go home. You know, the kind of the pain and the suffering you go through at home when you have to explain to your spouse that you lost your job. Not through any fault of yours. It's just the economy turned down and there wasn't any money. There wasn't any clients.
What's the one thing you would do as soon as you could if you're elected governor?
Open those copper nickel mines up north. Real easy. That is the economic engine that would make the North Dakota oil fields pale in comparison. It would make the dot-com bubble. It would make Silicon Valley. Any of the big economic booms that we have seen.
You're saying that the opening of the Polymet mine would make Silicon Valley pale in comparison?
I think so, yeah. I really think it could.
In terms of economic, that's a driver of billions of dollars.
Yeah, I think it could, because we would have that copper nickel, the spinoff that could come with that. It, you know, you look at any iPhone, Nook, iPad that's got a nickel battery inside there. Oh, and that's just, those are the two that we're talking about. There's palladium, titanium, there's gold. You just start that mining opportunity. And what we've done with taconite, which is part of our cultural heritage, that is something that has done, you know, absolutely phenomenal things for economic development. Lots of kids went to college because their dads were able to work in those mines. But what we did with that is we put it on a barge and we shipped it out. What we should do, and what I would propose in this next generation, is we start the processing there. So we process that nickel, build it into the batteries that we then export. So you bring manufacturing. The mining is one thing. That'll be worth billions. But then the copper processing, the nickel processing that comes with it, those smart factories that we build on the Iron Range now, that's where the next generation of Minnesotans, and they get to live where they want to live, not where they have to live.
Politicians right now are not a very popular bunch, certainly nationally, depending on, it doesn't matter, irrespective of party, it seems. A lot of cynicism there. So what is driving you to do this?
You know, that actually, that's one of the reasons why. You know, somebody who, and I talked to a guy at the gym this morning, he's a retired Minneapolis cop. He said, Kurt, we want somebody like us, you know, somebody that we can trust. We know you will go down there. You know, it's not like you hate government. He said, I'm a cop. He said, I worked for the government. He said, I know you won't be disrespectful to government, but you'll make them live like the rest of us have to on a limited budget. You know, we can't just go spend when we want to on stuff that we think would be really cool like a train that goes between Minneapolis and St. Paul that takes 53 minutes. Sounded good, but in practice it isn't. Buses would be a much better alternative. So I think it's little things like that that you understand. And if you haven't been, you know, out in the workforce, if you haven't been in government, but also in the private sector, like I have my entire time in the Capitol, you have that perspective. And I think that's what people are looking for. And you know what? I'll be honest with them when they say, I'm not going to raise your taxes. Yeah, it might mean some tough decisions, but I think that's what they're looking to, because raising taxes, quite honestly, that's the easy way out. Oh, we'll just raise taxes. We'll just go get some people. There's a small group of people. How many people know a billionaire? I sure don't. But you can go tax them, take their money, and give it to somebody else. That's the easy answer. The tough thing is making people introduce technology to make efficiencies, to build in new technology that we haven't used before, to try something different, to make sure that government is more lean and more efficient.
Your time as House Speaker, your TV ad that's up now talks about that. Some would say there's baggage there for you and Republicans. The government shut down. It was pretty ugly. There were a couple of divisive amendments on the ballot, and Republicans lost the House. So how do you respond to those criticisms that maybe it was not the triumphal success that you're portraying it?
Well, and I think the easy answer is the shutdown was the governor's on his watch.
There was no blame on your side.
Well,
for
we presented the budget to him the last day before the shutdown is the budget he signed after the shutdown. And he said on WCCO TV, yeah, I guess I should have read it more closely. I thought there were a bunch of things I objected to in there, but there wasn't. So we didn't have to go through it. We sent him numerous bills that would keep, as they say, the lights on. So from that standpoint, and the point isn't that we shut down government. The point is we balanced a budget deficit of $6 billion into a $3 billion surplus, sent our economy on an upward projection rather than a downward, and we cut the unemployment rate. We put Minnesotans back to work. That's what I'm proud of. The government shutdown is what my Democrat opponents want to focus on because they don't want to give us the credit for balancing that budget. In fact, Governor Dayton's now running commercials, or at least talking about it, saying he balanced the $6 billion or $5 billion deficit by raising taxes on rich people, which that didn't happen until the second year or the third year of his term, not in the first 2 years when we were in charge.
How are you different from your fellow Republicans who will be on the ballot Tuesday?
Well, for Republican voters especially, I'm the only guy that's faced down Governor Dayton. And on the key issues, which I think what, and I've been out talking to Minnesotans like all the rest of the candidates have, it's economics. It is the budget. It is, what are you going to do? What's your plan? And I'm, since I'm a farm kid, I don't have visions. That's some politicians have visions. I have a plan. My plan is to put Minnesotans back to work, whether it's in the copper nickel, whether it's in financial services, whether it's building more STEM schools, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics schools, so that more of 3M's engineers come from here in Minnesota than from all over the world. That's what's happening right now. That's where I think that experience that I've had as speaker, whether it comes from balancing the budget or putting together an agenda. And then for primary voters, it's looking at it and saying, this is what Zeller's passed. This is what Governor Dayton vetoed. It's a very clear choice for Minnesotans. The rest of the guys would have to say, this is what I would do or what I could do if given the opportunity. I can show them in black and white, here's the things that I've done.
That was Minnesota gubernatorial hopeful Kurt Zellers speaking with Tom Cram. Our series of conversations with the Republican candidates continues on All Things Considered. You can learn more about all the candidates running in Tuesday's primary online at nprnews.org. And that'll do it for the NPR News update for this Thursday, August 7th. I'm Matt Sepik. Thanks for downloading.